China is engaged in a nuclear modernization program of its own. It's adding new types of nuclear capabilities.
China says it is not a U.S. nuclear adversary. It's Monday, February 5th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Britain not ready to ride the Belt and Road, defending against North Korean missiles, Australia plans to sell arms, a microplastics ban, and the Super Bowl. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China on Sunday criticized a U.S. government report labeling it as a potential nuclear adversary and called on Washington to reduce its own nuclear arsenal. In a formal statement, a spokesman for the Chinese Defense Ministry said the Chinese side expresses firm opposition to the report. The statement went on to say, "We hope the United States will abandon a Cold War mentality and earnestly shoulder its special and prior responsibility for its own nuclear disarmament." It pledged that China will never be the first to use nuclear weapons under any circumstances. The Pentagon released its 2018 Nuclear Posture Review on Friday, outlining U.S. plans for updating the United States' current arsenal in order to deter nuclear attacks. The report also detailed a new strategy for China designed to prevent Beijing from mistakenly concluding that it could secure an advantage through the limited use of its theater nuclear capabilities, or that any use of nuclear weapons, however limited, is acceptable. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Alexandra Bell. She is Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and served in the U.S. State Department during the Obama administration. Melman asked Bell if she was surprised by China's reaction.
Not surprised at all that China has expressed concerns about the Trump administration's nuclear posture review. It is a document that is giving the impression that the United States is pushing to increase the size and the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy. And it would stand to reason that China would see that as a potential threat. China has long maintained what we refer to as a minimal deterrent force of just under 300 nuclear weapons, only about 100 of which could reach the United States. The United States, on the other hand, has about 4,000 nuclear weapons in its active nuclear stockpile. So there's a very large difference between the nuclear arsenals of China and the United States.
So is China trying to lessen the tension here or just level criticism?
I believe China wanted to make it clear that it found this nuclear posture review to be problematic. At the same time, China is engaged in a nuclear modernization program of its own. It's adding new types of nuclear capabilities. It's moving towards potentially putting multiple warheads on missiles, something that it's often referred to as MIRVing. And also, it has allowed the international community to start debating whether or not China was actually committed to a no-first-use policy, the idea that they would never use nuclear weapons first. Now, I'm glad to see that the Chinese officially reaffirm their commitment to this policy, but the question is, why was it ever under debate in the first place?
Overall, how does the Pentagon report differ from past reports?
The last one was in 2010 under President Obama, and this nuclear posture review, unfortunately, is a move away from the previous report insofar as it, again, is pushing to increase the size and the role of nuclear weapons, really breaking with decades-long precedent of bipartisan support for reducing the role of nuclear weapons and moving away from an increased global arsenal.
What about world opinion after this report has come out? Are more countries perhaps siding with China? What are some of the, we've already heard reactions from Russia, I do believe, but worldwide, what do you hear?
I imagine that the world is concerned about this move by the Trump administration. It is no secret that people have been concerned about some of the rhetoric that President Trump himself has used when talking about nuclear weapons, and in particular, the types of aggressive comments he's made towards North Korea and specifically to Kim Jong-un. So I don't imagine this is going to make people feel better. At the same time, again, China and Russia and other nuclear weapon states like China and, like India and Pakistan have been investing in the modernization and potential expansion of their nuclear forces. All nuclear weapon states are playing a role in increasing nuclear threats right now, unfortunately. Just in general, if China is concerned about the Trump administration's nuclear posture review, it should engage the United States. It should be talking to the United States and, in fact, all nuclear weapon states about strategic stability, about where we should be going in our efforts to reduce nuclear threats, to stop proliferation. And there are items like the ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that, you know, there's nothing stopping the Chinese government from moving forward with ratification of that treaty. Indeed, it would be a signal that China wants to lead global efforts in reducing nuclear threats, and it would put pressure on the United States to follow suit.
Alexandra Bell is Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
China has the world's fifth largest nuclear arsenal with 270 warheads, according to a Stockholm International Peace Research Institute report that was released last June. That report says the United States has 6,800, falling just behind Russia. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. North Korea to send high-level delegation to Winter Olympics in South Korea. Vice President Pence intent to counter North Korea's Olympic charm offensive. China says to the United States, we are not a nuclear adversary. Australia unveils plans to boost international arms sales. Anti-U.S. base mayor seeks re-election in Okinawa's Nago City. Expanded coverage of these story and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, and we also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Britain has made clear its desire to be part of China's so-called One Belt, One Road initiative, a cornerstone of President Xi Jinping's vision to boost Chinese investment and influence across Asia, Europe, and Africa. There are, however, concerns over the financial and humanitarian costs of the vast infrastructure projects being undertaken. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the United States has issued a blunt warning over what it sees as the dangers of being tied to China's huge investment projects.
A traditional Chinese dragon dance welcomed British Prime Minister Theresa May to Beijing, where she led a delegation of ministers and business leaders in an effort to boost trade after Britain's European Union exit. The two countries signed deals worth $12.7 billion, and May hailed a golden era of Sino-British relations. Her ambassador to Beijing, Barbara Woodward, earlier outlined Britain's hopes of cooperating in China's One Belt, One Road initiative.
The first is we'd like to collaborate on practical projects. The second area where we'd like to collaborate with China is bringing some of our City of London financing experience, because these projects are big projects, particularly in infrastructure. They require complex funding mechanisms.
Too complex, according to some. Some 9,500 kilometers away in Uganda, one of China's latest One Belt, One Road projects is about to be completed. Soaring above the muddy swamp between the capital, Kampala, and its airport, the new 51-kilometer four-lane expressway was built by the China Communications Construction Company, and its $580 million cost was met with a loan from Beijing. Kampala's mayor, Erias Lukwago, says the price is too high.
Even these Chinese who are coming here from even the commercial banks we are borrowing from, Exim Banks and whatnot, the burden will finally come on our shoulders as Ugandans. So our children and grandchildren will have to shoulder this burden, which is very, very unfortunate.
China has invested across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East under the One Belt Initiative, and even into Eastern Europe. Britain should tread carefully in its dealings, says Barnaby Willits-King of the Overseas Development Institute.
Particularly in fragile parts of the world where China's Belt and Road Initiative is going to be running through, there are a lot of potential risks around, you know, humanitarian concerns, environmental concerns that I think focusing just on a trade deal might overlook. But it's also got an advantage. You know, the UK has worked and invested in a lot of these countries over the years, and it could actually provide some very practical advice to China.
Washington has gone further in its criticism of China's trade and foreign policy. US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offered this warning ahead of his trip to Latin America Thursday.
China, as it does in emerging markets throughout the world, offers the appearance of an attractive path to development. But in reality, this often involves trading short-term gains for long-term dependency.
Many emerging economies welcome China's investments and the involvement of countries like Britain. But there are concerns that mounting debts will cause big problems further down the road. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Happening now in Asia, officials in Seoul say North Korea's ceremonial head of state will lead a high-level Pyongyang delegation to the Winter Olympics in South Korea later this week. The North Korean visit reflects a possible easing of tensions. The two Koreas are still officially at war after the Korean conflict in the early 1950s ended. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's Monday morning. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Last week, Central Intelligence Agency Director Mike Pompeo warned North Korea could have a nuclear weapon capable of hitting the United States mainland within a handful of months. Earlier, he said the North's nuclear arsenal could be used for coercion, not just self-defense. Part of the U.S. response to such an event is to try to intercept an incoming missile. But a test missile launched from Hawaii on Wednesday apparently failed to intercept one fired from an aircraft aimed amid heightened tensions over a growing threat of a nuclear strike by North Korea. Although the U.S. Missile Defense Agency did not issue a statement, the failure was acknowledged by a U.S. official in several media reports. It was the second failure of the missile, identified as Standard Missile 3 Block 2A, with the last one occurring in June. They followed a successful test a year ago. Cedric Layton, a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer who now operates an independent crisis management consultancy, tells VOA's Victor Beatty years of such tests have yielded a success rate of about 40%.
When you look at a success rate of that level, it becomes clear that there are going to be operational failures. Now, the idea of launching a target missile from an aircraft and then having that intercepted is maybe not the most realistic replication of a potential launch from a country like North Korea, but it is one of the ways in which the U.S. tests its weapon systems. They do varying tests. The fact that this particular intercept was attempted from a shore-based battery as opposed to a shipborne battery is also different, and it, in theory, would be more stable being on the shore, but it is, a slight difference from what would happen if it was the standard Aegis-type missile. So what we're dealing with here is a series of tests under varying conditions that are, at best, very difficult to construct, but they are also not direct replications of exactly what the North Koreans can do.
Is this a new generation missile, or are we defenseless against any possible North Korean attack?
We are not defenseless against North Korean attacks, but what we have to understand is that any defense system that we currently have is not going to be foolproof unless we have complete knowledge and understanding of what the North Koreans are up to and get lucky in our attempt to shoot those missiles down.
Are they working on a new generation missile?
So there are several blocks, several variants to these types of missile interceptors. So this Block 2A of the SM-3 is basically a version that the United States is using that is updated from previous versions. options. So it is a slightly different variant. It has basically different parameters, different ranges that it can use, and it's designed to be more accurate, but it's also one of those systems that is designed to make sure that each type of missile, whether it's a short-range missile, an intermediate-range missile, or a long-range missile, that we have ways of getting at each one of those. And this was designed for short and intermediate-range missiles as targets, and that's the system that is being used because we believe those are the missiles that are most likely to threaten forces in places like Japan, Korea, and Guam.
Cedric Layton said while a success would have sent a better message to North Korea, Pyongyang should not read too much into this failure. He said the United States has other ways to go after North Korean missile batteries. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
News alert from VOA Asia. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence embarks on a trip this week to Northeast Asia to help counter North Korea's charm offensive at the Winter Olympics. Pence's presence will be due to his, quote, grave concerns that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will hijack the messaging around the Olympics. The messaging is exciting and true at VOA Asia Facebook. Visit each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Australia has set out an ambitious strategy to become one of the world's top 10 weapons exporters within 10 years. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports, ministers say the plan will boost global peacekeeping efforts as well as create thousands of jobs in Australia.
Australia wants to sell more of its military technology and hardware, including armored vehicles and surveillance systems. It currently sells about $1.6 billion worth of weapons each year and is ranked 20th in a global list of arms exporters, but it has ambitions to break into the top 10. There'll be government grants to help companies boost sales. Australian Minister for Defence Industry Christopher Pyne says the plan could create tens of thousands of jobs. He says it will also boost international peacekeeping efforts.
Our primary market is New Zealand, Canada, the UK and the United States. That is where the vast majority of our effort will be placed and has been placed. We need a strong alliances with those kinds of countries, with the capabilities that we need militarily to ensure that we maintain peace in the world. I don't think anybody would question our role in places like Iraq and Syria most recently.
The plan has been anticipated since mid-2017, when Pyne said he wanted to sell more Australian-made weapons overseas. At the time, the charity World Vision said the policy was exporting death and profiting from bloodshed. Aid organisations said the move wouldn't boost global peace efforts, a claim rejected by the Australian government. Officials have asserted that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. The United States is the world's largest arms exporter, followed by Russia, China, France, Germany and the UK, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the Australian government is investigating the discovery of thousands of files dating back 10 years and spanning five governments found in file drawers at a second-hand furniture store in the Australian capital of Canberra. Australian intelligence officers have since resecured the sensitive documents. Visit VOA Asia Facebook as we reveal details of all the big stories every day. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the world has another ally in the war against microplastics. Just before Christmas, the Italian government voted to ban the tiny beads that show up primarily in beauty products by the year 2020. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us Italy joins a growing list of countries, the United States included, that have banned microplastic products.
Microplastics, tiny bits of plastic less than 5 millimeters in size, show up primarily in toothpaste and beauty products. The problem is, once they go down the drain, they end up everywhere in the water supply. But that has just changed in Italy.
We passed a law to ban microplastics from cosmetics and cotton buds. Beginning in 2019, it will be prohibited to use cotton buds that do not have biodegradable sticks. And regarding microplastics, beginning in 2020, cosmetics containing microplastics will be prohibited.
Banning microplastics is not just about keeping the oceans clean, it's about keeping our food chain healthy.
Clearly, a purifier able to capture these minuscule plastic little balls does not exist. They end up in the sea. Once they get into the sea, they are easily mistaken as plankton by fish, and so we eat fish with plastic.
Cosmetics companies have been reducing microplastics in their products for years and say they will be gone entirely before the law goes into effect.
We gave ourselves a goal by 2020. So the fact that 80 products which still contain those substances were found in Italy in different shops is in line with our expectations. This said, the new law, and above all, our own recommendations mean that, if not before, at the latest by 2020, all will be eliminated. But again, we are very confident, given the available data, that we will reach the goal much earlier.
Scientists are worried these kinds of microplastics may be doing some serious unknown harm to all living things.
What we know is that a group of substances, the phthalates, represent a threat to our health. They can be found in plastic materials, and then by passing through the food chain, they can end up in the human body. Phthalates are what we define as endocrine disruptors. Those substances can influence and disrupt hormone levels. In some cases, they are also capable of affecting the reproductive system.
But getting rid of microplastics will not do much to stop the 8 million tons of plastic that end up in the oceans every year. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Each year, the Super Bowl is a spectacle, whether or not you're a fan of professional American-style football. Millions of people across the United States and many, many more around the world will be gathering to watch the NFL championship game, or at least pay some attention to the television commercials and extravagant halftime show. It's usually very cold outside at this time of year in the United States, for most of it anyway, and that's a great excuse to enjoy the game with family and friends indoors. On the eve of the Super Bowl, football fans from near and far were in this year's host city, Minneapolis, in the Midwestern U.S. state of Minnesota. And there, they spent the night before the big game outside in snow and below freezing temperatures, celebrating at the biggest football party of the year. VOA's Brian Allen takes you there.
It's negative 11 degrees Celsius, but it feels like negative 20. The sun has set and the wind is whipping. Anywhere else, and that would be the perfect excuse to stay indoors. But here in Minneapolis, on the eve of the biggest football game of the year, the biggest party of the year is outside in the streets. Super Bowl Live is more than a week of non-stop entertainment, leading up to Sunday's NFL championship. The theme of the party is the Bold North. To most, the idea of being outside in this weather is something more than bold, but here in the North, it's just life.
Why not, though? Where else are you going to be able to do this? To come to a place like Minneapolis where, you know, you spend 3-4 months in this kind of weather and just enjoy it, absorb it, and it's something like nothing, no other Super Bowl is ever going to be.
This isn't that cold. This is warm right now.
The weather is beautiful.
This is what we do.
And this is what we do as Minnesotans.
Like any good party, Super Bowl Live has lots to do. Take the ultimate winter selfie inside your own life-size snow globe. Dance and sing with local bands. Eat, then eat some more. On the same block, but inside, thankfully, you can also catch some adorable young cats playing in their own feline version of the Super Bowl, the Kitten Bowl. Back outside, the snow is really picking up, and some locals berate us for our climate-controlled indoor detour.
You can't just hide inside all day, you know?
It's Minnesota. Experience the culture and the weather, and it's what it's about.
And that's exactly what we do, out in the cold alongside thousands of others who have come to Minneapolis for the Super Bowl, and the local residents who show us how to truly party like Minnesotans. Brian Allen, VOA News, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Will it be the New England Patriots or the Philadelphia Eagles? We'll be sure to stop by and listen to our program tomorrow for that answer, or if you really need to know before then. VOA Asia Facebook and VOAnews.com will be on top of the latest happening in the big game. We're glad that you've been listening to VOA Asia. You can catch us on the radio if you happen to be in Singapore at Media Biz Radio at Temasek Polytechnic. Thanks to everyone there who is listening today. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, John Ellison, managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a super day.